They tuck it away and run for it inside the five, and he's in for the Lions touchdown.
Barry Sanders turned around a defensive back about three times. Wow.
The guy is trying to tackle him, but he's got his back to Barry because he can't find him.
Here's a touchdown, Lions. Holy mackerel, what a run by Barry Sanders.
Detroit. There'll be a 15-yard penalty on the kickoff, but the play is not reviewable.
Welcome to a special edition of the Roar of the Lions UK podcast. My name's Matthew Turner. I'm joined by my co-hosts, Stephen Collins, Ryan McCluskey, and recurring guest, Tom Wilkinson. We have a very special guest with us too, Kent B. Platty, a.k.a. Math Bomb on Twitter. He is the founder of the Relative Athletic Score, or RAS, as you may otherwise know it, the pinnacle of relative scoring when it comes to draftees and what have you. Kent, thanks so much for coming on, man. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, appreciate it for having me.
So quickly, if I'm sure everyone knows who you are, but just quickly introduce yourself to our listeners, if you please.
Yeah, I've been covering football in some fashion since about 2009. I started writing about the Detroit Lions because that's my team, unfortunately, sometimes. I started doing relative athletic scores in 2013. I was trying to find a way to develop a way to quantify athletic testing that wasn't just, oh, he's quick, but not fast, or, oh, he's unathletic, or he's athletic. I didn't really like the fact that all these buzzwords existed, but there was no context to them. So I developed RAS in 2013. It's been evolving ever since then. The calculation has only been changed once since 2017, and that was just to fix a small little tweak. I've been updating it every year. The website now is ras.football. I changed over the URL this year because that's easier to remember than that really long one that I used to have. But yeah, you can look up any player that has athletic testing recorded from 1987 all the way to 2021. I just brought on an intern for the first time ever. So we're going to have some rolling content, hopefully some more stuff coming rather than just me on occasion doing things.
Fantastic. So we're going to start with a bit about you, and then we're going to go on to a bit on RAS, and then maybe a bit on the Lions to finish, if that's okay. So you served in the Navy to, I think, start your career out of school, possibly. Were you always statistically minded through school, and did your time in the forces kind of help develop that? What was their contribution to your career now?
It didn't start out as statistics. So I was a cryptologist in the Navy, which is breaking code and all that stuff. It was a lot less exciting than it sounds like. It is always sounds much cooler than it is. But it was all pattern recognition. It was all finding patterns where there didn't appear to be one. And I always enjoyed that aspect of it. I always thought that was fun. I enjoyed ciphers and things like that and trying to break things. When I got out of the Navy, I jumped right into coding. I did that a little bit towards the tail end, but I coded a little bit and then jumped out and jumped right into coding, because that's the same thing. It's all finding patterns or finding ways to make patterns happen to make sure that things go that way. That just kind of naturally evolved into statistics in one way, shape, or form. And then when I started doing the metric stuff, and I started really digging into it, a lot of those patterns just pop right out at you. I mean, you start looking at one or trying to go down a rabbit hole to see if something exists, and you find those patterns. They're all there. So it's less the statistics part than it is the patterns.
I've got a question for you. My name's Ryan. Thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. So you've been here right now for the POD for roughly 5 years. Before that, you were a senior writer at the Silver Dome Blues. So back then, you would have been a bit more fan-oriented. How has it been different writing now for POD? Have you found yourself having to be a bit more objective, a bit more realistic, sometimes a bit more negative than positive? Have you had to keep it a bit more structured that sense, and what have you enjoyed most about the transition?
I love Pride of Detroit. I actually stopped writing for Pride of Detroit a while ago just because I couldn't balance the time. But it's it was a big change going from the Silver Dome Blues from there to I actually wrote for Sideline Report for a little while, and then on to Pride of Detroit. And it was different at each of them. They expected different types of writing. Silver Dome Blues, it was very it was very much just me and a couple of dudes that liked writing about the Lions. So we just did that. A lot of it was pretty positive. The general vibe with the team was fairly positive at the time. It was still fairly early in the rebuild under Schwartz. So we were pretty positive vibes at the time. Sideline Report, it was very demanding for the amount of content that we put out, and they really didn't like long pieces. So they limited how much you could write in any given piece, which stifled creativity a little bit, but it also forced you to find different ways to get out the same types of ideas by having it packaged in a different size package. So it was a beneficial experience. It just didn't feel right for my style of writing. Never had that problem with Pride of Detroit. It was all about being as creative as you could, finding your own voice. We have a lot of different voices. There are a lot of different types of writers at Pride of Detroit, and everybody there is different. It always makes me laugh when people kind of bunch everybody together, because if you saw the conversations that we had as a group, you would never think that we were the same type of people that have some collective mindset. It doesn't really work that way. I'm still in the Slack group with those guys. I still keep in touch with all of them. They're all great guys. And it's still like that. It's still a very competitive atmosphere with a lot of guys that really love the team, love covering the team, both the positives and the negatives. You know, you can't just drink the Kool-Aid, and you can't drink the Haterade either. You gotta take a little bit of both, in my opinion. You got to take a little bit of both and try to find a happy medium where you're talking about the team as objectively as possible without losing that subjectivity that you have by just being a writer and having your own opinion about something.
And Ken, given the work you're doing with RAS and PFN, how does that change the way that you watch the game as a fan?
Drastically changed the way I watch the game as a fan, and stepping away from Pride of Detroit did that quite a bit too, because I started looking at the team, the NFL, more from a draft perspective and a more 32 team perspective. Once I started covering specifically the draft for Pro Football Network, right now I maintain their mock draft simulator, and I do some applications development for them. But it's a very different mindset when you're watching a player that is never going to be on your team. You know, when I was with Pride of Detroit, we still had Matt Patricia when I left, and you're watching a linebacker and he's really good and he's flying all over the field. Maybe he's got some flaws here and there, but you really like his game overall, except he was 235 pounds. Well, they're never going to draft him. He was just off their draft board. Matt Patricia would never draft a linebacker that was 235 pounds that he was thinking about starting. He might draft a special teamer that he wants to put back there, but he was never drafting a linebacker that small. And it's not even that small, but he wanted his guys, huge hulking guys. It's a different mindset when you're looking at it from any team perspective. It's much more liberating in that respect. But it forces you to be more creative about how you watch players and how you watch other teams. Because I'm not watching other teams as these are people that the Lions can face. I'm watching other teams trying to notice their tendencies, noticing how their coaches are watching stuff, how their types of schemes work with different types of players. It's very challenging, but it's a lot of fun. And I've been fortunate at Pride of Detroit and with Pro Football Network to have just a lot of great guys to work with. And being able to share those ideas has been awesome.
Just to follow up on that, with how all of the teams draft, where the front office remains consistent, do you find that their philosophy when it comes to the Athletic score is consistent?
It's different depending on the team. I'm going to have more on this in the next couple of months, because that's part of the data that I have to dig through right now. That's why I brought an intern on to help me dig through some of that data to try to find some of those trends. I've already found some just by doing some really basic stuff. But you see it just by paying attention to the fan bases. And honestly, doing stuff like Raz, you see it a lot with who likes my stuff versus who doesn't. Like Packers fans jump all over it. And that's because Gutekunst loves grabbing superb athletes, loves going out and getting those guys. The Colts are another team that they love their super athletes. The Eagles, they never draft poor athletes on their offensive line. All their offensive linemen have to be these just top tier athletes because that's just the type of guys that they prefer. And then you have teams like the Ravens where I don't know what they're doing. They've been doing this so well for so long, and I'm sure there are trends. I just don't know what they are. I haven't been able to identify what those trends are. But I don't have as large of a following among the Baltimore Ravens because I think because a lot of their guys don't really test that well, that still turn out well. Because it isn't just athletic scores. It's not just athletic testing that makes good players. It's a lot more that goes into it. It's been really interesting, though, seeing some of that change from a perspective approach when you really start to dig into it with people and they start to talk about it. Because I'm not I don't drink my own Kool-Aid. I'm not sitting here and going, oh, I'm only drafting high RAS guys ever. No low RAS guys ever going to be successful. Except at tight end, I do believe that one. But I generally tend to look at it as, you know, that's a piece of the puzzle. It's something that you look at as part of it. And when you start to talk to people from other fan bases and they come in fresh, not knowing who I am and what I talk about, they think I'm this going to be a honk. That's just going to be like, no, if you don't have a good score, you're bad. It's the higher score is better. Always the lower score don't matter. And it's not really like that. There's always some nuance to it. And it's been really interesting to explore that, and both as working for Pro Football Network and doing all that, the draft stuff, and just working on relative athletic scores in general.
So if you don't know what RAS is all about, for me, and having looked at scores and having looked at how people test, it's, oh, so this wide receiver runs a 4.4. That's fast. And it's like, okay, but quantifying how fast is what it's all about. So in what percentile is this guy in terms of the height, the weight, the, you know, agility, everything that you test on there, it's about actually quantifying exactly what the generic terms, which have no meaning, actually say. But in terms of perhaps the more interesting question we're thinking about, because you've kind of talked about why RAS happened before, we've been talking in our WhatsApp chat with some of the listeners that we have about, like, exactly not why it happened, but when it happened, in terms of when you have an idea in your head, you can see something that's going to be a good idea. Most of the time you kind of hold on to that. You're like, well, someone should do this. What was it that was the kind of the moment where you were like, no, I'm going to be the one that does this. I'm going to start doing it right now. Is it, as a Lions fan, that you kind of seen the draft strategy, you've seen them take a few guys, you're like, well, they don't look particularly athletic. I wonder how bad they are. I have this idea in my head that you saw Mikel LeShaw being drafted in round 2 and you were like, no, that's a bad idea. One, is a running back and that's too high. And two, he's not athletic enough to justify that high standing. And I think the timeline kind of fits for that, but I'm sure it's just completely mad. What was the kind of light bulb moment for you that it was the thing to do?
It actually had nothing to do with the Lions. And there are moments like that, it's especially in hindsight. And if, God, strolling down memory lane and how bad some of the general managers of the Lions have been is just incredible. That 2008 group where they had Gosdar Chehrilis and I don't even remember the linebacker we drafted in the second round. They were both just a mess from an athletic standpoint and a personal standpoint. They both got arrested for DUIs like a week before the draft. And the Lions were still like, we're going to build our whole franchise around these guys. It's messy. But it actually started with guys like Von Miller, guys like Le'Veon Bell is a huge one that I always bring up because it's a very easy example. Le'Veon Bell ran a 4.6 coming out from Michigan State. And I live right next to MSU campus, or I work right next to MSU campus now. At the time, I lived in Texas. I didn't live anywhere near MSU. But the idea that he was a bad athlete at the time blew my mind because they always talked about his 40-yard dash. Like, it was the only thing that mattered. Like, Le'Veon Bell was just not good at anything athletically, and he was only this careful, patient guy. But he didn't test poorly. Like, a 4.6 isn't even terrible for a running back. It's not great speed, obviously. 4.6 isn't great, but it's not so slow that it's a concern either. And his 10-yard split was really good, 78th percentile for a running back. His three cone was 6.75, which is 95th percentile, which is not a bad score, obviously, 95th percentile. But for a 230-pound running back, hitting a 95th percentile in an agility score is bonkers. You never get that type of score. So the idea that he was a poor athlete just blew my mind that it got repeated so much. And anybody that was fast was a great athlete. It didn't matter how they tested anywhere else. If they ran a good 40, they were the greatest athlete ever. And you still see that. That still happens every year. But there's more to athletic testing than the 40-yard dash. There's more to an athletic profile than just one metric. And I really wanted to find a way to quantify that. I at first tried to look into different ways to do that. That wasn't me. Different ways to do that. And I settled on doing a 0 to 10 score because it was easy to understand. The metric was developed to be fan facing. So I wanted this to be something that somebody could look at and easily understand. And 0 to 10 is as easy as it gets. 0 is bad. 10 is good. And that was even before I color coded it. Because now it's even easier. Red is bad. Green is good. You know, it's much easier to figure this stuff out. But the idea was making it so that it's contextualized in a way that we can understand. All that nuance and all that stuff about really digging into the numbers and not just taking the numbers at face value, the experts can do that. The guys who've been doing this for years, people who are really interested in the draft can do that. But casual fans, one number is fine. we don't need to have 47 numbers that tell us all that stuff. And if a guy comes in and he's a 90th percentile athlete, like Le'Veon Bell was almost a 90th percentile athlete, then I don't care that his one test was middle of the road, right? So it kind of morphed off of that. And then guys like Von Miller was just an absolute freak mutant alien. I had watched some obstacle course thing that Von Miller had did with Kelvin Shepard was there, and I forget who the other people that I watched there were, but one guy did it and was just completely out of breath and sweating and everything, and then Kelvin Shepard did this obstacle course, and Kelvin Shepard's a decent athlete. He's a good, decent tester, but you know, he went through it and he was out of breath, but he did it in like half the time. And then Von Miller did it, and Von Miller is huge. Von Miller is massive. And he did it in half the time of Kelvin Shepard, and he didn't even break a sweat, and he wasn't even out of breath. And I remember him going one part, they had to climb under this monkey bar set they had that was really low to the ground. And they had to climb under it. And he just put one hand on the ground and like swung his whole body underneath it because he was just so quick and so agile for his size. And I remember just being like, how is that humanly possible? How is that remotely normal? Von Miller was a 9.99 RAS guy. He was way up there. But stuff like that, finding a way to quantify that was fun for me. It was fun. That's the long story around that. It's just, it was fun and I enjoyed doing it. That's why I did it.
I've got a question. Actually, I've got two because I can combine this with one of the WhatsApp groups. In the early days of RAS, the data entry must have been quite difficult and time consuming because I imagine you must have started in Excel spreadsheets, yeah, running formulas before you could start coding. How did you manage to keep on top of that? Were you getting many mistakes? And if you're looking at RAS now and back then, what are things that can still be worked on? Is there any improvements that can be made still? Or is there things that you're not always happy with? Like, how is the growth of it from like this humble Excel spreadsheet to now this data coding, all flashing colors, bells and lights? Like, it's fantastic, the growth of it.
Yeah, it's changed quite a bit, man. I still see those Excel ones that I posted back in like 2014 or 2015 every now and again. And it's just like, oh, my eyes. I built it in Excel first. I moved from Excel. I stayed in Excel and actually built a program in Excel that would do that work for me in Visual Basic, do all the coding, because it was too big for Excel to just run the calculations anymore. It took too long to try to find a player because there was so much data, and Excel is a very limited program. I moved it into Access very briefly so I could run some queries against it. I don't think I even ever posted anything from there. I then built an actual VB application that I use, which allowed me to do better queries. I moved from there to Java-based that allowed me to do a lot better queries and do some more neat visual stuff. I hate visuals, hate doing visuals. I work in a very visual medium. I'm a document developer by trade, which you think like I would be good at visual stuff, working with documents all the time. I'm not. So I moved from that. And then last year, I moved online. Everything now is entirely built through the website, which is why you can go on and look up anything. Mistake prone. Yeah, a lot of that is mistake prone. There's so much manual effort in data entry. And even if you're scripting some of that, even if you're getting it from reliable sources where you're scripting some stuff, which I did early on, I don't do anymore because it's very hard to source and people should always make sure they're sourcing their data when they can. But I did that early on, and it's even then, if the source is incorrect, then you're incorrect. That's just the way that it is. You're somebody's wrong, then you're wrong. There has to be ways to manage that. And that's one of the things I've always been trying to do better. I did a data clean effort just recently where I found hundreds of mistakes. And it was usually little stuff like a misspelling, or I didn't have an apostrophe in somebody's name because the old code didn't like apostrophes. I have a better coding now, so I get around that. But I had a lot of schools wrong. I'd have the occasional metrics that were incorrect, but I'm totally fine with people pointing that out when I have stuff wrong. I have pride in the data that I put together and the work that I put into it, but I think it would be a disservice to everyone, including myself, if I didn't accept criticism of the data, because if the data is wrong, then you're presenting something incorrectly. Randy Moss is a really good example. The data that I have for Randy Moss is questionable. I have it from two different sources. So it's not even something I have from one source, from two different sources. I have it from an AFC scout from the time and, NFL Combine Metrics, I think, was the other one, the website. But some of that data is probably not correct. And I know that because I've looked up media sources from time. I've looked up a bunch of stuff. But anything pre-2000 is very difficult to find data on anyway. You get different results. And Randy Moss is like the worst of that. I found six different versions of his vertical jump. And a vertical jump should be just pretty simple because it's just one test. They just jump. They jump twice and they take the better number. It's not hard. But I found six different versions of it. I take the most commonly sourced number when I have a discrepancy like that. I don't take the best number. I don't take the best. I always take the most commonly sourced number.
And how do you integrate the kind of estimated data? Because obviously there's maybe a bit of a trend now where certain players don't run certain drills at the combine or the pro day. How do you kind of build in that ability to put that estimated data in without kind of being too objective?
There's a lot of math, and I don't do it as much anymore because there's a visualization aspect of it, and I don't like to put things on a regular card when it's projected data. I want to have something that visually says, this is projected, this isn't the actual scores. If something is unofficial, it'll be highlighted in yellow. I have a flag that'll highlight it in yellow if it's unofficial. But for something that's projected, it's just a lot of math. You get a lot of people who will just post whatever that they see the scores. Oh, yeah, this guy ran a 4.4 and a 42-inch vertical and da-da-da. It doesn't really come from anywhere. I'm totally for putting those numbers up there. I actually have a calculator on the site where you can go put in whatever numbers you want, to see what the scores would shake out as. But when I'm recording numbers, I have a method to make sure that whatever numbers that go in that database and stay there are officially recorded somewhere. So I can point back to it and be like, this is where I got that number from. If it's incorrect, it's them, not me. And that's not me trying to be like, I didn't do it. It ain't me, guys. If my numbers are incorrect, they should be corrected, but I'm not the one that found the numbers in most cases. So I can't be the one to correct them, and I can't just go change them on a whim. I have to have a reason, valid reason, and a source that I can point to correct that, to make sure that we have the right data. We always strive to have better data. One of the other things I want to fix is when I don't, or when there's a question, I want to be able to point that out on the site. That Randy Moss thing, for instance, I want to be able to put that on the site where I can say, hey, there's an issue with this because of XYZ reason. But everything on the site is program driven. I can't just go to his page and change one thing. I have to make a change that impacts every player in some way, or a table that I have to pull from. And it doesn't make sense to do that for a one-off because it's just putting in time and effort for something you're only using once. right? So I just have to have time to build some of that out. I have it on my list of things for the intern.
You already spoken about Le'Veon Bell. Who are some of the other success stories that maybe Raz has had in terms of highlighting players that perhaps didn't have the college production or weren't as heralded coming out that Raz has highlighted as being athletically gifted and they've come on to be a big success in the pros?
Aaron Jones for the Packers, unfortunately, was a really good example of that. He was a later round pick, but he was a fantastic athlete. They had Jamal Williams at the time, who's here. Jamal Williams is a fine running back, but he was never like a lead back type of guy. Even in college, he didn't really project that way because he's still a little athletically limited in what he could do. Whereas Aaron Jones didn't have that. He was very high upside, high variance, but high upside type of player. He got that opportunity. Opportunity is king in the NFL. And he got that opportunity and he took advantage of it. He was able to work with it. The Lions tried the same thing with Dwayne Washington. And apparently you also have to be able to see where you're going to be able to be a good running back, and he couldn't. Max Crosby is another really good example. He went over here to Eastern Michigan over at Ipsy, so he was a bit local grown. So I knew a little bit more about him at the time. But he was another guy that people weren't really very high on coming out of college, a mid-round guy. And he blew up in the league once he got here. It's one of the only good defensive pass rushers that the Raiders had. You know, he's a really good player. And if you're really looking for high upside in your mid to late rounds, you should look for those types of players. One of the best ones is Danielle Hunter from the Vikings. Danielle Hunter's college tape was trash. He was not a good pass rusher in college. He had this move where he would put his shoulder into the blocker and then just kind of push. You may recognize that as not a real pass rusher. I realize that. But he was a supreme athlete that popped on tape every time he turned it on. He went to a very good place for his type of skill set with a coach that could build from it. And he blew up because he just taught him how to use those talents and build from them. Coaching is another thing that really needs to be taken into consideration when guys are drafted, because you can have all the talent in the world, but if you got bad coaching, it don't matter.
And is there a flip side to that? So other players that have had terrible RAS scores and you're watching them and they're like, you know, absolutely smashing it on the field and you're just thinking, how is this happening?
All the time. Everybody loves to point to Tom Brady. Tom Brady tested terribly. He actually had a good cone time, which is a thing that has come up many times around the years about quarterbacks and their cone times. As bad of an athlete as everybody wants to pretend that Tom Brady was, he was, he had a good cone time. He didn't have a poor cone time. So he wasn't a completely garbage athlete. It's really fun to find those guys that had poor scores, though. My favorite one is still Jarvis Landry just because of how bad it was. Vontaze Burfict is actually the second lowest Pro Bowler when it comes to RAS, but Vontaze Burfict also wasn't trying. He tanked every part of the combine. But Jarvis Landry was just injured. He had a hamstring injury at the time. And he has five of the worst metrics for any receiver that either made a Pro Bowl or had a 1,000-yard season. And five of the 10 metrics for the worst are all Jarvis Landry. He did not test well at all. He tested better at his pro day, but still not great. Anquan Boldin didn't test very good. And it's really good to look at guys like that. And I use receivers just because it's easier to explain because you can visualize it, I think, a little better. But, Anquan Boldin didn't win because he was fast. He was a bigger guy, but he wasn't super big. He wasn't Calvin Johnson sized or anything. He wasn't particularly explosive at the line, but he was incredible when it came to the catch point and using his physicality and his body to box out receivers like a tight end does. And when that ball was in the air, you had to beat him for that football. And that's a type of game that very few corners play. Very few cornerbacks can play, beat this guy physically in the air for that football. And Anquan Boldin was such a master at that. that he was able to flip that into a very long career because he was good enough in everything else. You know, he didn't test well, but he was good enough with all of his other metrics that it's fine. It's like Nuck Hopkins. Nuck Hopkins didn't test very well, but he tested good enough that it's not a deficiency. It's not something that's really holding him back. Larry Warford, that the Lions drafted in the third round, Larry Warford tested terribly. He came to the combine out of shape. I always love to go back to it because we have those superlatives that people use about players. And at the NFL combine, Larry Warford was referred to as having a sloppy build, which is like the worst way that you can explain how somebody looks when they're just up there in their underwear. Right. But Quandre Diggs, another guy that didn't test very well, and did well, required a position change for him to really become good in the NFL. What's another good one? There's so many of them. Travis Frederick, who people didn't even think was a first rounder when Travis Frederick was drafted. Travis Frederick was drafted by the Cowboys. And when he was drafted, people were blasting that pick as, oh, he's a third round talent. There's no reason to be picking him that high. He tested terribly, and he did. And then he went on to become the best center in the NFL for half a decade, you know, before injuries took him down. But there's a lot of them. And the trick is finding out why. Sometimes it's an injury. Darius Leonard for the Colts injured his hamstring during his 40-yard dash. You can actually go watch it on tape and see him injure his hamstring. So his testing is explainable. He was just hurt. Jarvis Landry, as I mentioned, was injured. He still tested poorly at his pro day, but he tested healthy at his pro day and tested much better. Those are explainable. Guys like Bolden, Wes Welker, who didn't test well, they just win in different ways. They didn't win because they had testable metrics that make sense. Orlando Brown is one of my favorite stories now, knowing that he's succeeded now because he tested a historically abysmal, one of the worst testers in the history of the NFL combine. But he also doesn't win with speed or explosiveness or lateral quickness as a blocker. He wins by using his length and an understanding of how to read body language. And he does a really good job of explaining himself. I keep meaning to grab that article where he had an interview where he basically explained why he wins in the NFL. And none of it was, I'm bigger, faster, stronger. It was all, I have a really wide wingspan and I'm able to use that to figure out knowing where guys are going to be. I'm able to block and keep them off of those places and able to use that length for leverage once I actually have my hands in somebody. It's fascinating to read up on guys that don't have those athletic traits and how they win in the NFL, because it's usually just a guy who figures out a way to overcome that, and they get so good at that thing that nobody can beat them because they're used to going after guys that are quick, that are fast, or whatever. They're not used to having some blocker with 85-inch wingspan who's getting them, and they just can't touch it because he's got them so far away from them. You know, they're not used to that.
So obviously PFF is grown.
Can I go?
Yeah.
So PFF has grown considerably over the past 10 years or so, obviously supported by Chris Collinsworth and a big marketing budget too. But also part of that has been correcting the true value of players. So giving fans a greater understanding of where that true value is. And you've touched on some of that already. And it's obviously something which Raz does too. And every year we see more media quoting Raz. It feels like the appetite for data within fans is getting more. You mentioned yourself, you've got an intern now. So what are the next steps to see Raz continue to grow over the next couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, I did not envision that I would be doing like team radio appearances and stuff when I started this. It's been very humbling to be a one-man show and to build this stuff up and get where I've gotten with it. But you can't just do that forever. You can't just be your one-man show because you get blinders on. You know, it's very easy to overlook something because, well, I didn't think of that. Why would I spend the time to go look at it? Not that I'm consciously doing that. I'm not some arrogant snob. Don't let the mustache and hat fool you. I'm not that dapper. but you know, it's, you gotta have some creativity. You gotta have some willingness to go out there and do the work and do the studies and try to find where that data matters, where it doesn't matter. And I need more people to do that. I recently got very ill. I had a bit of a scare, which is unfortunate. And I've had to really drag back the amount of work that I'm doing, which is why I brought on an intern. But I also very naively only expected like a couple of people to apply to to be an intern because it's an unpaid internship. I expected a couple of people and that was it. And I had to cut off at 50 applicants when I got that many people because there was, like you said, there's an appetite for it. People want to get in there and they weren't deterred by the fact that I wouldn't be paying them for it because the site doesn't make enough money for me to pay staff. But I need help. And they were just like, access to the database? Yes, please. I'm all for that. That has changed considerably what I'm thinking about doing with the site. And I'm actually going to be starting a mentorship program for not just people that are interested in football, but people that are interested in coding, people that are interested in analytics, people that are interested in math. A lot of the applicants that I got weren't even football fans. They were, I literally had a doctor interviewing for an internship where I wouldn't be paid. It was a very interesting experience. But the reason is people want to learn how to look at data, how to evaluate data, how to build a data structure that you can use to build something useful that other people want. And I think that means more people. I think that means bringing in more people. So I'm going to be starting a mentorship program in the coming weeks where I will be allowing a select group of people to have access to the RAS database. I'll be providing training and I'm still working out all the details, but I'm providing, you know, training and access and things like that, where they can just go in and dig through the data and try to find stuff that they want to find. Maybe they find something cool that I've never even bothered to look for. Maybe they find a bunch of stuff that I've started to look into that, because I'm going to kind of point them at some things. Maybe they'll find those things out and find, oh, yeah, this actually means something. Or maybe it doesn't. Maybe it doesn't matter at all. Maybe they'll finally figure out what the hell's going on with centers, because I don't even know what the hell's going on at center. Maybe they'll figure that stuff out and it's just going to be more people. I'm not going to just open up the database as a public database. I tried doing that before and people screw it up for everybody else. But I am going to open it up to a select group of people and allow them to get in and look at the data and try to come up with more stuff. Hopefully that'll be really cool and we'll get a bunch of people that are learning new things and posting new discoveries and finding new ways to evaluate data and talk about football.
So last question before we perhaps move on to a bit more of the Lions-based stuff, but I guess it's kind of related to RAS, but not really. Is there another element to the statistical analysis which happens in the NFL at the moment which interests you specifically? That you're like, this is really cool. I'm not involved in it, but I would love to be if I had more time. One of the things I know that some of the over-the-cap guys are doing is kind of looking at production per dollar, which I think is a really cool thing to look at. Is there anything that you think is a really cool thing which is happening right now?
I've met a lot of great data people over the course of putting this stuff out. You know, data guys tend to not so much flock together, but we tend to follow each other's work because even if you disagree with it, it's usually pretty interesting, right? And even if you don't like it, you can be like, I don't like it because here's the data reason why I don't like it. You know, you still get to get into it. You mentioned the salary stuff. Over the cap has always been really good when it comes to that stuff and finding out different ways to look because it's providing information. You want to know what guys are getting paid, how much they would get, the team would lose if they were cut, and the types of moves that teams can make and all stuff. That's interesting. It's valuable as fans, valuable to fans, but they're always really good at finding other angles. I've really liked a lot of the stuff the NFL has been doing with health, with trying to figure out different ways to avoid player injuries, changing the helmet structure around and things like that. I don't know if there's a good data angle there, but I follow helmet health. I follow what the types of helmets that people are creating. I find that interesting. I think it's neat that they're trying to find different ways, and they're doing it because of money. They're doing it because they make money off it. The players stay healthy, they get more money. Doesn't matter. They don't really care that much about the players, but you know, regardless of why they're doing it, the end game here is to find, you know, better helmets. And the amount of studies, the amount of science that goes into just creating a piece of plastic that they put on their head is fascinating to me. I also really like some of the stuff they're looking at with the GPS. The Lions, of course, are really big into that right now. They're not throwing out traditional metrics. I know some people suggested that they don't. They still follow that stuff just in a different way. They weight it differently than previous staff said, like Patricia didn't at all. But you know, it's really interesting to look at how that stuff's going to evolve, how much they're going to start using it, and it's going to be a while. Just for the same reason that something like RAS doesn't have as much value looking at players in the 90s versus players in the 2010s, because the volume is different. And if you don't have sufficient volume behind your data, you're going to have a lot of really misleading conclusions that you can come to. Which is why a lot of my studies tend to be, you know, from 2000 on, here's the results from because my data was a lot bigger by that point, and there's sufficient data to really start making some conclusions. So there's a lot of stuff I follow. I love data. Like I said, I love math, data, analytics, all this stuff is my right my jam.
Should we talk some Lions?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm going to go pre-draft first before we actually go on to the draft class. So I remember going back kind of January, February, you were pretty vocal around the Lions taking a quarterback. So when we traded for Stafford, got Goff in return, I remember having a good laugh at some of the comments that would then come into this, of fans just completely refusing to accept that that could be a possibility. I guess from your side of things, how frustrating is it seeing fans who are seemingly convinced that Goff is the future and drafting a QB just wasn't even an option?
So it's a little different because of Goff. So I'll break up your question into two parts. So drafting a quarterback in general, is a good idea for a rebuilding franchise. You got to have somebody that's going to lead your franchise from the start, somebody that can really build up from, build around. And it's not just because the quarterback touches the ball every play. It's not just that passing games are becoming more and more prevalent. It's not that the game is changing and we're getting that shift from complete pocket passers to guys that can operate out of structure. All of those things are important, but it's not just that. It's also that teams tend to build their entire offensive identity around their quarterback. And there isn't a team in the NFL right now that doesn't have an offensive identity that's built around their quarterback. Even the Tennessee Titans, who have Derrick Henry, and they have that smash mouth, punch you in the face offense. They still have a passing game that's built around Tannehill and A.J. Brown. And you saw that with their offseason move, what they did this offseason and bringing in another premier receiving threat. It's still built that way. And the Lions need to do that because we're rebuilding. Rebuilding is never fun. It's never good to go through a rebuild. You can call it other stuff. I hate the teams try to rebrand it as something else, but it is what it is. But it's because of that. You're building an identity. You got to start where you need to build one from, which is the quarterback. Goff, I've just watched too much Goff. Whenever I miss on a player, if there's a guy that I think is good and he ends up being trash, or if there's a guy who I think is bad who ends up being good, I go back and I watch him a lot. I watch a lot of them. Because for me, that's how you learn. That's how you improve. Because if you watch a guy and you're like, wow, he's really good. I think he's going to be really good. And then he is really good. You're not going to learn as much by going back and watching their tape. Because whatever it was you thought you saw, you are probably right on. Not necessarily, but probably. If you think a guy's going to be bad and then he's good, you miss something. There's something you did wrong. There's a flaw in your evaluation process. So when Goff came out and was absolute trash first year, I didn't really care because first years don't mean that much to me. But it was kind of validating when you don't really have a high grade on a player. And I didn't. I had I gave round grades back then. I think I had a third round grade on him. But it's when he started to get good, I went back and I rewatched him. And generally, I will learn from that. I will go back and I'll watch a player and I'll be like, oh, this is the thing I'm missing. I did it with Orlando Brown. Thankfully, I had a cheat because Orlando Brown told us what he was doing. So it was a lot easier to go back to his tape and kind of review it. But there's examples like that where you go back and you look at it like, oh, this is the thing that I was getting wrong. I liked Ereck Flowers coming out because I was an idiot back then. I was really wrong on that. And what it was I was overvaluing how much an offensive lineman could do after they got past the line of scrimmage. Ereck Flowers was great when he got out of space. He would just flatten linebackers and even bigger off defensive linemen once he got past the line. And you go back and watch him and you're like, you know, he's never actually getting past the line. Like when he did, it was because somebody missed him. Like somebody else was engaged and was able to get off. So you go back and you find things that you missed. I didn't get that with Goff. And this is before he was even on the Lions radar. I didn't see anything new. I didn't see anything that I felt I missed. I thought he looked exactly the same in the pros as he did in college, just in a better schematic position where things were kind of in his favor. Similar to how Kirk Cousins is right now, where Kirk Cousins is, as long as he's got receiving targets and a good passing game and his run game's not trash, he can deal. He's still going to throw some stupid interception because he thinks he can do more with his arm than he can. Goff was the same kind of guy. He's absolutely no mobility as a runner. He doesn't operate well out of structure when he's outside of the pocket. He doesn't really read defenses all that well, especially deep. He still had that. That was still there. I wasn't missing anything per se. And then the Lions picked him up. And you go back to your talking yourself into it, right? You try to talk yourself into it. But I'd watched so much of him that it's just lying to yourself to go back and be like, well, I really did like this thing. I didn't have any of those things that I liked when he wasn't a Lion, when I had no reason to cheer for him. He seems like a really nice guy. He seems like a really cool guy. Joey Harrington was a really cool guy. He was Joey Blue Skies, man, back in the day. You know, Goff seems like he's a really nice guy. I just don't think he's a very good quarterback. He's a lower tier starter. You can't build around that. And he's a very expensive lower tier starter. So he's going to put up a bunch of yards. I mean, they're going to throw a lot because they're going to have to. But he doesn't have that number one defense. He's got a pretty good passing, pass blocking team and a reasonably good running game that we're hoping will hold up with just two guys. So as long as everybody stays healthy, he should still put up a good amount of passing yards. I just think he's going to have a ridiculous amount of interceptions and fumbles because he just doesn't like holding on to the football. So it is what it is. You got to deal with it.
And then coming on to the Lions draft class of this year. So, you know, I mean, obviously we've kind of been talking about this to death before the draft, during the draft, after the draft. And, you know, I mean, you can see, you know, you've got Sewell at 8.9, Raz Melifonwu, I think, topped out at 9.69. Amon Raz, you know, down a bit at 7.1, down to Jefferson at 2.2. So I guess the question for you is, we were talking earlier about the Ravens, and you never quite managed to crack the Ravens draft code cipher. Based on what you see with the Lions draft class, have you cracked the Brad Holmes draft cipher yet?
I hope so, but no, it's going to take a few drafts to kind of get an idea. I did a study of Holmes. I think it's still up on the site, actually. I had a GM study where you could go pull up any of the GM candidates and look at their entire draft history. And I did that for Holmes. He has a very specific type of guys that he likes in most positions. He broke from that in 2021 at a couple of positions, at offensive tackle specifically. And it's good that he did, because his history with offensive linemen has been very spotty. He's drafted a couple of good but not great guys who didn't test well. And that's good, you know, if you get value for him. But they're picking Penei Sewell very high, and picking very high, you can't take those types of risks. And he didn't. He didn't take a risk. He grabbed a top-tier athlete with a top-tier pick. His wide receiver, Amon-Ra St. Brown, you mentioned he didn't test as high, 7.14. He isn't a great tester, but he is a pretty good football player, and that didn't break from Holmes's tendency. He's had a really good history with drafting wide receivers at good value, which he did with St. Brown. Guys that didn't test well but had really good tape, like St. Brown, like Cooper Kupp, like other guys like that. He's got that history. He carried that over here. So it doesn't worry me that Amon-Ra St. Brown didn't test elite like some of the other guys that he picked, because that's the type of tendency that Holmes had. Similarly, both of his defensive tackle picks were top-tier athletes. He's done that with the Rams, with top-tier athletes on his interior line. I think the only guy that didn't test well was Brockers, and Brockers is still a really good player. He had great tape coming out. So it doesn't worry me. I think that he's followed a lot of trends that he has. I feel like he's learned from some of the mistakes that he's made. Jefferson was a seventh round pick, which is just a dibs on a UDFA. So I'm not really worried about that one either. Sixth and seventh round picks are just calling dibs on guys that are probably not going to get drafted in most circumstances. And that's not a dig against Jefferson or any sixth or seventh round pick. That's just how the draft works. You know, you go from your once you get past the third round, the fourth and fifth rounds don't even really mean all that much either. That's usually where teams start to target, like special teamers and things. But he hasn't broken any of his good trends. And that's important to me. And it's possible that he has broken some of his bad trends. And that's also important to me. I think that he did a really good job with this draft. And the only pick I had any complaint with was their late seventh rounder, and I don't even care. So it's like, whatever.
So you think that, like, on Mazarike, taking him at the second pick when, like, Murig, the safety, was still on the board, you're happy with that?
I am. I wasn't as big of a fan of Murek, but it's also the type of trends that he has. Murek didn't fit that tendency. Holmes has a very specific type when it comes to safeties, and it's not, oh, just ridiculous top-tier athletes. He looks for guys that maybe aren't top-tier testing fast, but they're quick or they're explosive. And Murek didn't really have – I mean, I think Eric Schlitt from Pride of Detroit used to be Lions wire at the time. I think he said he kind of just hit that threshold of the type of guy that Holmes has looked for. But he didn't, from what I usually look at with those types of things. And I don't think he was really looking for that. They do need a safety. I just think that they prioritized building one entire group up before they started working on other stuff, which is fine as a rebuilding strategy. I know there's some people who don't like that strategy, and it can be really mind-numbing when you're trying to wrap your head around why they took a defensive tackle and then a defensive tackle. But I had to literally leave the Pro Football Network webcast we were doing at the time, which was work. I was at work, and I had to leave when the Lions took Alim McNeil because I was that excited. I had to leave and go to the Pride of Detroit guys and go celebrate for a minute because I was so happy they got that pick, because nose tackles is another one of those things that a lot of people screw up, because nose tackles aren't usually that athletic. But the best ones are, and the Lions went out and got one of the most athletic nose tackles from the last 10 years. And I love that they did that. I was so happy that they did it. It's not a super high value position, but they didn't spend a high value pick on it. Spent a pretty good value pick on it, but not a super high value. They didn't spend a first or second round pick on it. But they did really good, I think, on their draft. I think they knocked it out.
When you were talking about Orlando Brown, I flicked immediately to Sewell, I have to say, because one of the things that really stands out on tape at Oregon is his ability to block a nickel corner or a linebacker. And I'm like, okay, now I have to think, is that actually going to happen in the pros? And probably not, right? So that element of his quick get off, he kind of releases almost like a wide receiver when he's actually going to try and block at the second level. But if he comes up against a defensive tackle or end who's going to just block him, then what good does that do you? So do you think that Sewell's going to struggle a little bit more than people are thinking? Because I think a lot of the projection on him is based on his athleticism.
It is. And Sewell's a different kind of athlete. You mentioned that he had an 8.9 RAS. That wasn't the highest for this class. It wasn't even close to the highest for this class. We had a ridiculous offensive tackle class from an athletic
Spencer standpoint. Brown was a 10, right?
Straight up 10. I mean, this is a 325 pound guy who ran a 4.89 and had a sub 7.3 cone. That's ridiculous. That's gonzo numbers. But Sewell is 330 pounds when he tested. He plays bigger than that. He's played as much as 350. And he's still incredibly athletic at that size. It's very hard to quantify how rare that is. It is not a common thing to have guys that big who are that athletic. Big guys tend to not be fast. They tend to not be very agile. And it's not just because they're big. It's because that's a lot of strain on your body. You get so much weight on your muscles and on your bones, it can be problematic. It's dangerous for some players if they're that big. That's why a lot of offensive linemen preemptively wear knee braces. That's why some teams simply require their players to wear knee braces, because it's a lot of strain to put on your body. Sewell has a very abnormal build. Abnormal is just meaning not normal, not meaning bad. He doesn't have your typical offensive lineman stocky build. He has a very, very broad shoulders, very thickly muscled from top to bottom. And the fact that he weighs as much as he does and is able to move the way that he does is very, very promising.
Is it almost like a tight end for you?
Yeah, my comparison to him was Jason Peters from the Eagles, who was a tight end coming out of, I just blanked on where he went to college, but he ended up going to Buffalo first and then went to the Eagles. And they immediately convert him to offensive tackle because you don't put 325 pound offense or tight ends out there anymore. I think he played at 330, 335, but that was the best comp for me was Peters, because you're talking about a guy who can move like a tight end, and he's bigger than most offensive tackles are. And offensive tackles are gigantic human beings. People don't realize how big they are. He's huge for an offensive tackle, and he moves like a tight end. That's big. There are times I think he doesn't use his length very well, and that was a concern that some people had, saying that he was should convert to guard. I'm not down with that concept in most cases. But that was the concern, is that he didn't really use his length very well. But as a run blocker, he's incredible. And as a pass blocker, he's almost flawless in most of the guys that he faced. And he didn't face the best pass rushing guys. He didn't face Chase Young and guys like that. But when he did face good pass rushers, he shut them down too. You know, you should shut down the bad pass rushers. You should also shut down the good ones if you're good at what you do. And he did those things. I'm very excited to see him play.
Who's the guy that you're most excited about out of the draft class? I remember a lot of the mocks beforehand. You had Onwuzurike, for example, in there for the Lions. I believe you have McNeil in there too. So I'm going to guess it's one of those two, but...
Yeah, I love those two guys. And this was a really weak defensive tackle class. Really weak. And that can scare some people because the Lions took two of them. But the worry with a weak class for any position, we'll talk about DT because that's what we're talking about there. The worry is that teams are going to draft them too early. They're going to say, I need this guy, and we got to go out and pick this guy. And that's where having a weak class is a problem. The Lions didn't do that. They still got awesome players. Onwuzurike is a dog, man. He's a mean, mean football player. And one of my buddies runs his own podcast, started doing interviews for NFL players, well, NFL prospects. I think he's done them the last 3 or 4 years he's been doing them. And he said he's never had a player swear on his podcast. They're always very courteous because they know it's going to be on radio or whatever. He only had one, and it was on Onwuzurike, and it was in his first sentence. He started that way. And I was like, part of me wants to think that didn't play into to Campbell drafting him, but you know that played into them drafting him. You know that it did. I'm very excited to see those guys play for different reasons. Onwuzurike is a very explosive interior pass rusher. I think you might see some penalties from him just because he's going to be a new player. He does rely on timing a lot. Most interior pass rushers are either guys with timing or guys who are just really explosive. Onwuzurike is both. But because he's so explosive and he tries to time the snap every time, he can get fooled. And I think in the pros, he'll have guys that know how to do that more often.
Oh, so, Green Bay is going to be awful.
Yeah. But he's so explosive, man. When he just gets that leverage on guys almost immediately. And it's so hard to beat him once he's got that. And McNeil is just so strong and such a good run defender. And as much as you talk about nose tackles and their run defense, he's a good enough pass rusher that I think you're going to see some of that too. Really fun player I'm excited for. Player I'm most excited for, though, is Amon-Ra St. Brown, just because he's going to have the best opportunities. This is a really weak receiving core that the Lions have. And Brad Holmes and Jared Goff both, they tend to like guys that can pass underneath, that can catch underneath. And it looks like that's what they're going to do with St. Brown. Goff is not a good deep passer, and that's what Perryman and Williams are. Those guys are both deep guys. So Amon-Ra St. Brown, I'm usually not high on any Lions player in fantasy just because they're just not usually a good value. Even Stafford in a lot of situations wasn't the greatest value, but Amon-Ra St. Brown as a mid-round rookie is in a better position to get a lot of targets than some of these first-round guys. I don't know that he's going to get all of that production. I don't know that he's going to be that awesome. He does have some flaws to his game. That's why he wasn't drafted earlier. But he's going to have a lot of opportunity, and I'm excited to see what he does because he's a chirper.
So with the draft in the rearview mirror, I guess, and we look back at the last 6 months, I remember when we hired Brad Holmes, and I imagine with Dan Campbell too, especially with Salah and people out there, you weren't particularly excited. I wasn't particularly excited, to be honest, too. I remember the thread when you went through and broke down some of his traits. As we look back on the last 6 months, how do you feel now, having seen, admittedly, no one snapped the ball yet? We haven't actually been on the field, but how do you feel looking back on this 6 months of Holmes and Campbell?
Yeah, and it people tell, whenever you're talking about guys that you want or guys that you don't really want, you know, Holmes wasn't like my bottom guy. You know, he wasn't the worst guy that I had in there. He just wasn't my top guy or my second guy. You know, I wanted God, guy that went down with the Colts, I'm blanking on his name. And then Fontenot, who went to the Falcons. You know, guys that I really like because I like their analytic approach. I like some of the way that they've approached player evaluation, player identification, both pro and in college. Holmes has been almost exclusively a college guy. He's done all of his scouting on the college end. And that's fine, but it also means that a lot of those trends are pretty easy to follow because he was there for a long time. And he did pretty much the same thing the whole time, just in varying degrees. I didn't like some of the ways that he approached certain positions. Offensive line, I already mentioned before, I didn't really like the way that he did that. Quarterback, and then they doubled down on it. Holmes has a horrible record with quarterbacks. He always drafts immobile, small-armed guys. So I was terrified that we were going to end up with Mac Jones or Kyle Trask. I'm still terrified that we're going to end up with Carson Strong next year, even though Carson Strong is a decent prospect. He's zero mobility, none, nothing. You're not moving from that pocket. I hate that. The NFL is not that way anymore. It hasn't been for a while. Evolve. If you don't evolve, the game is going to run right past you.
So Slovis as well then, right?
I'm not a big fan of Slovis either. Slovis has some injury stuff. I'm a bit harsh on Slovis because I've only really watched his post-injury tape, and he was terrible post-injury, terrible, legitimately bad, shouldn't be drafted. I had him undraftable until we started our 22 talks, because at that point I had only watched that tape and I didn't have pre-injury tape to go back to. I wasn't very high and strong either, in big part because of that, because it's not just being able to run. It's being able to be mobile in the pocket, being able to operate outside of structure, being able to, not making it a focal point of your game, but having that as something you can do. Justin Herbert wasn't a rusher in college, but he was a great athlete, and he had the ability to do a lot of stuff outside of the pocket and to move around really well. I think that's why the three-cone drill is so important for quarterbacks, because it shows that you can maneuver a little bit, even if you're just inside the pocket. Drew Brees was one of the most mobile quarterbacks in the NFL. He was never a rusher, but people look at mobility as ability to rush. Drew Brees was fantastic maneuvering around the pocket and using that ability to maneuver around guys, figure out where he needed to be, how he needed to adjust himself when he had blockers in the way of defenders coming. That's also mobility. We need somebody who can do that and don't currently have it. So we'll look ahead to next year and the year after. I don't know how long they're planning for this rebuild, so I don't know how long out they're going to look. It could be next year. It could be 2022 or 2023.
Well, that leads into my question, like, say, with the rebuild on the roster. So we've just left behind the Quinn Trisher era, where you've stated you were watching linebackers and you just know, yeah, they're never going to pick these kind of guys. They did never pick Derek Barnes. He's too small. They loved Reggie Ragland, Christian Jones, Tavai, Kyle Van Noy, these big guys that are wading through sand, pretty unathletic. Looking at the state of the roster right now, where are the strengths, the weaknesses, and how many years of additions until we're able to turn it around, in your opinion? Like, how far off we are off a wild card spot, maybe, for an example?
I think we're at least 2 years out. A lot of the strengths and weaknesses of this team are still the same as they were last year, and they didn't have a lot of strengths last year. One of the pieces of data that I was able to pull from the recent study that I'm working on is AV data for Pro Football Reference. And the 2022 Lions were bottom six for every position on defense, every single one. That is not good. That is very bad. you don't want that. Linebacking group was the worst in the NFL by that metric and by many metrics. Jeff Risden, who I'm sure you guys know Jeff. Jeff claims that the Browns were worse. They were second worst by that metric. So splitting hairs. They're a long ways off. They've got a lot of stuff to do. But I think that if they're building their offensive line the way that it looks like they are, around much better athletes, guys that have some size and some mean to them, that's a good way to build an offensive line. I think that's a good method to building a strong offensive line. The Colts have done it. The Eagles had a really strong offensive line for a lot of years. The Cowboys' best offensive lines were like that. The Lions are building that way, that type of offensive line. That's good. We want that. It's a good sign. I don't have enough information on receiver because they've only drafted one and the rest of the guys are rentals. So I don't know what they're doing there yet. It feels like Holmes is going to do the same type of thing he did with the Rams, That involved a lot of trades, though, so I don't know how that's going to end up looking. From an offensive standpoint, I'm worried if they're building around Goff. If they're not, and this is just a bridge, and they're getting the rest of the foundation that they can in place until they can position themselves for a better quarterback, they're doing that the right way. If they legitimately think Goff is the dude, I have concerns. As far as the defense goes, I really like what they're doing with their defensive backfield. Bringing in a guy like Ifeatu Melifonwu is a really strong move, not just from a value standpoint, but from a traits standpoint. He enters a group with Jeff Okuda and Amani Oruwariye, where you have a lot of guys that can do the same types of things. They're all athletically similar types of guys, but there's a lot of versatility where you can move guys around. What Patricia did wrong was Patricia's focused almost exclusively on man type of coverage schemes, which limits that strength. If you have a lot of guys that can do it all, do things with them, move them around, have them adjust coverage, have them have movement pre and post snap. Don't just, all right, you line up over there against that guy. You go up against that guy. That's wasting the type of talent that you picked. And Patricia did that. He wasted the types of talents that he had in that secondary. Don't like that at all. I'm hopeful that the coaching is able to take that type of player and build from it rather than just let it rot and wither. I think why they did that is because they had just drafted Okuda and Oruwariye looked good after his first year. So they already have a foundation and piece that's in place, that's young, that's potentially productive. So I like that's the approach they took. Drafting a guy like Derek Barnes is really smart, and I'm glad that's the type of player that they're going, not just because it's such a dramatic turn from Patricia's types of linebackers, but because you need fast linebackers if you're going to have corners that can move all over the place. You got to have guys that can take advantage of the strengths that you're trying to build, and I think that's what they're doing. They've got the potentially disruptive interior defensive linemen. They've got cornerbacks that can move all over the field from right up against the line and man to zone to being all the way back at safety. They can move wherever you need them to. Even what they did with Ford and some of the other guys, the lower tier guys on their roster, where they've been moving guys around safety and stuff. That's smart. You have to build with those strengths, you know. I think it's very promising. You mentioned that thread that I did on Holmes. Almost everything positive in that was about his defense and the way that his defenses were built and the way that they built up those types of players. Very positive initial impressions of what they're trying to do, just not what they have to work with. They don't have a lot to work with. We're talking about two rookies on the interior. The rest of their defensive tackles probably wouldn't start for any other team in the NFL or even get in much of a rotation. Their defensive ends are underwhelming. Flowers hasn't lived up to his billing. Okwara did his best in the second half of last year. I'm hoping that's not a flash in the pan. I'm hoping that's a thing that he keeps going. But anytime you have a short period of production, it's worrisome. The other Okwara has been hurt. Hopefully he gets better. Austin Bryant hasn't really done anything. He's been hurt a lot too. But I don't think that those are the types of guys they're going to have back there anyway. I think they're going to build a very different looking defense. It's just going to take some time.
Still any concern that we pump resources into running back? I mean, Jamal Williams is here for 2 years, but
awful.
Holmes is track record.
Anytime, and that was one of the issues I had with Holmes, was that Holmes has a history of drafting running backs high, misvaluing a position that doesn't have a lot of value. Drafting DeAndre Swift was a bad idea. Swift has been okay. I know he's being hyped up like he's going to be the best running back in the league, but we have seen this before. They did this with Kerryon Johnson after year one. Mikel Ashour had, 10 touchdowns, maybe, whatever it was. He had a ton of touchdowns 1 year because they just kept feeding him, giving him all that volume. You know, the Lions have this trend where they'll draft a running back high and just wait until he breaks and then draft another running back high.
Yeah, I've been best.
I'm a little worried that they only got Jamal Williams and a seventh rounder who might not even really make the team. I think that they need to pull in somebody else to add to that running back rotation and really make it dynamic. And also so that you can spell guys, because Swift has an injury history. Williams doesn't have as much of one, but he's not clean there either. Running back's already a position where injuries are very prevalent. You want to protect yourself against that type of stuff. It's less that they invested heavily into it, because that was prior to Holmes coming in, that they didn't they didn't rebuild what they had let walk, right? They let some guys go, and they didn't really do anything with it because it's basically a two-man show. That's really it right now. It's dangerous. It's risky.
That's the end of our planned questions. Has anyone got anything that occurs to them?
I've got a question. Like, football is the only real sport that has the actual pro days and a combine. But if you were to look at Raz and tweak it, is there any other sports you feel like you could possibly rework this to? Would there be a way of example like baseball? Could you take their speed between the stops, how fast they hit, hard they hit, how fast the ball is? Like, is there other metrics you could work this up for other sports?
I think there's a lot of stuff we can do. You could probably have stopped after football is the only sport. Stop there. I've been asked about basketball before. I've been asked about baseball and hockey. I am sure that there is an application for it. I have zero interest in exploring it. This is another part of why I'm very interested now in trying to bring in other people to look at some of this data and to learn how to look at data and how to manipulate it on their own. Because I had people ask about that, about what if we did this with baseball? What if we did this with basketball? What if we did this with hockey? What if we did this with the medical field? What if we did this with other things that we wanted to do? You know, there's a lot of stuff that you can do with metrics and analytics. Baseball is way ahead of football in terms of analytics. There's so much analytics in baseball. It's insane now. That doesn't mean we've got it all explored. There's still more out there. We just got to find it. Find somebody that's interested in baseball. Teach them how to work with data. Set them loose into the world. Let them go find their things. I think stuff like that is totally applicable. And I think that from an athletic testing standpoint, at least from a hockey and basketball standpoint, from the very, very limited amount that I looked into it, I feel like there would be some value. There's a problem with volume when it comes to basketball, and there's a problem with reliability when it comes to hockey in terms of the data that you get. But these types of metrics get recorded because they're valuable, because there's a use to it. Except the bench, which I'm not even sure if that there's a reason for the bench in a lot of cases. I'm an anti-bench person. A lot better ways to measure strength. But I have, that's a whole, we could have a whole show on just things I would do better if I was in charge of the combine.
One thing I wanted to ask is a bit nerdier, I guess, but only very slightly, which is about the players themselves and how the data is distributed. Is it a normal distribution, even at this elite level, looking at the players? You know, there's a majority of people who are around or about between 4 and 6 in the testing, and it kind of peters out. Or is it more chi-squared in terms of being like lower, more players at the lower end of the distribution?
So that's a multi-tiered answer. Individual metrics are on a bell curve, just like most statistical anythings are on a bell curve. There's no way to get around that. The individual RAS scores for individual testing metrics are on a bell curve. There's just no way to get around it. RAS itself is uniformly distributed. It's how it was designed. So there are always the same number of players between any two equidistant points. So there are, let's say there's 100 players or 110 players, just because we're equally 0 to 10 is actually 11 scale. We have 110 players. There's going to be 10 guys between 0 and 1, 10 guys between 4 and 5, 10 guys between 9 and 10, always within one or two players every year. That doesn't hold up over time because there's a different number of players every year, and not every player from each season is going to be equally distributed. We have some years like this year where we have a majority of guys above average than below. That's not common. People mistook that as being, oh, all the times are being juiced. It's not really what's going on. What was going on was we had a much lower volume of players testing than we normally do. If we had the normal volume of players testing, we probably would have seen the same type of year we normally do, which is actually more players below average than above. The reason we had what we had this year is the same reason we always have this type of percentage right after the combine. The best athletes tested. That's all there was to it. But every year it's different. And every year before 2010, we tended to have more years where guys were above average than below. And then every year from 2010 to 2020, we had significantly more players below average than above. And then this year we're back to being above again. That's volume. The reason for that from 2010 onwards is the improvements that we have had in terms of reporting. More teams are taking the combine seriously, so that more players are actively going to the combine and measuring. Players in 2005 didn't really test at the combine all that much. They would skip it and just maybe do something at their pro day. That was just common at the time. That's not the case. It hasn't been since 2010. Players usually test at the combine. More players are testing at their pro days. Guys that never would have even had an opportunity to test are testing at their pro days, which is why we get a lot lower scores, because a lot of guys that probably shouldn't be testing also test at their pro days because they can. So I think that's going to continue. I think next year, if the COVID stuff starts to lift, which we should see at least some of that by the time that draft period comes around in terms of how the pro days are handled, I think you'll start to see that more. You'll start to see more guys coming out testing again and some of that cleaning itself back up.
Just a very quick one then. Are you worried about the added variability of the combine moving away from Indianapolis? Because that's always been a consistent track, for example, and consistent measurements. If they then start touring that round like they're doing the draft, you then get a new surface added to the mix every year. And then that is probably going to move the numbers a little bit. Is that a concern?
I think it's interesting. We know that there's differences in tracks. We don't know what that looks like. I did have somebody trying to explain their data. They had actually went through some of that data. I didn't agree with their conclusions, but there's some of that that can be tracked. There's some of that that can be quantified. We just don't have all the science on it yet. And there's no good way to do that without a lot more data and a lot more study. Because the amount of data, this is why I didn't like his conclusions. The data is very limited, very limited. You can't go just by players who tested on that track, because that's a variable in and of itself. So if one player runs on this track and then another player runs on a different track, you're not testing the track. You're testing the player more than you're testing the track. There has to be some kind of isolated test to be able to find that stuff. I think it's fascinating. I would love for the NFL to do that, to make that kind of study. But they don't innovate a whole lot when it comes to testing. We've had the same NFL tests since 1985, when the combine first started. They haven't changed anything, really. They've added the 60-yard shuttle. I think that's the only thing that they did. And nobody even cares.
And I know this is like a ridiculously, sort of daft question to ask at this time of the season, but where do you think the Lions will be picking next season, and what position do you think they'll be going for, or even a player if you've got one? But what position?
1 to 5. I don't have a lot of faith in what Goff can do with the Lions. I think their roster, like I said, is still a couple years away. Lions in year one of their rebuild under Schwartz won 2 games. They won 2 games that season. And that was with Stafford, who was playing terribly and they got hurt. But I don't really see that. I don't see this as that good of a team. Not that good of a team meaning a 2-win team, but a good team meaning they're going to win more than that. I think they're picking in the top 5, probably the top 2. I think they should target a quarterback if they can. It's difficult in this draft class because there isn't a quarterback that stands out the way that the top 4 did last year. At this time last year, Trevor Lawrence was number 1, Justin Fields was number 2, and Trey Lance was number 3. And that didn't happen in the draft. We still end up with quarterbacks 1, 2, and 3. That's because there's always somebody, right, that came out, Zach Wilson in this instance, who came out and really blew up. But there's no clear-cut number 1 guy that you can be like, that is the number 1 overall pick for sure. We've got Sam Howell, Spencer Rattler, Malik Willis. I mentioned Carson Strong, Keaton Slovis, who I don't think those guys are there, but they're in that mix for the national markets right now. But nobody agrees on any of these rankings. I'm actually having that discussion with our PFN group this week about quarterbacks, because our own rankings disagree with our own rankings. And we're not just going to switch one to the other, because they're different types of rankings. There is no consensus number 1 guy, and the Lions are probably going to target a quarterback even despite that. We're probably going to have a consensus number 1 guy by the time the draft comes around next year. If the Lions think this is a multi-year rebuild, which it is, if they think it's far enough out that they don't want to risk it on a quarterback that might not be the guy, and the 2023 class maybe looks better. I don't think it does at this moment because it's way too early. But if that's the case, by the time we're talking about this next year, maybe they skip out on quarterback and they get Kayvon Thibodeau from Oregon, who is insane as a pass rusher. That's who I would take if I was drafting that high. I'm blanking on his name, safety.
Kyle Hamilton.
Yes, thank you. You knew who I was talking about. I didn't even have to clarify. Hamilton from Notre Dame is incredible, incredible player. You don't usually talk about safeties that high, but he is an awesome player. We're talking your Derwin James or Jalen Ramsey level of player, that level of player, as far as how he's considered right now. Evan Neal is a tackle. I don't think that they go that way. There was a buddy of mine that had talked about the potential of them moving Decker sometime in the next two seasons. So I don't want to rule it out because he made a convincing argument as to why that was even a possibility. But I disagree with that. But that would be one to watch if that happens, as another tackle still trying to build out from the trenches. If they fall outside of that top five, you've still got a really talented group there, and you start getting into where it's okay to take the receivers that we have, like Chris Olave from Ohio State, Garrett Wilson, also from Ohio State, Treylon Burks from Arkansas. You start falling into those types of guys. You're also falling into where those mid-tier quarterbacks would be, which for me right now would be Malik Willis. I mentioned Carson Strong, who I don't like, but I do have him ranked there because I don't just use my own rankings to put the stuff out that's publicly available. That would be rude. But Desmond Ridder is another one, a guy with all the tools in the world that needs to clean up a lot of parts of his game. If he does, that's a mid first round guy right there. I'm not sure. It could go anywhere. We're in the midst of a rebuild. So they have so many different positions that they could target. They're going to draft two receivers next year. I mean, you can write that in Sharpie. Whether it's the first round and the fourth or fifth or second and fifth or something like that, they're going to draft at least two guys next year.
I just hope Goff works out, because Thibodeau or Hamilton would be absolutely amazing.
Even if Goff doesn't, they do have a second first round pick for the next two seasons. So there's always that possibility they could still grab Thibodeau and a guy like Ridder or Willis or some other quarterback. Matt Corral from Ole Miss is a guy that I love. If you get a chance to watch Matt Corral, go watch his good games and then watch his bad games and try to figure out how that's the same player.
We did a pod last night and I said, watch his games. I said, he's my wild card pick. People watch his games. Just don't watch the LSU or the Arkansas game.
I think he had it's something like 11 or 13 interceptions or something like that.
11, he threw six.
Yeah, but most of them were two games. Like he just had two atrocious football games and then a bunch of incredibly good football games, right? And then just
I'm glad you've said that, because I suddenly feel more justified and less crazy.
I mean, he had five touchdowns in those two games, but it was five touchdowns and 11 interceptions. but he's a fun player too. He's another guy that if he cleans up whatever was going on in those games, he could jump way up there. It's not an untalented quarterback group. That's the part that makes it interesting with how the Lions could draft, because even if they really like one of the quarterbacks in the next class, they've got value there because of that additional first round pick. So they could just be like, well, we'll see if one of those guys falls far enough. And they could do it. It worked for the Bears. I mean, they got Justin Fields. It could happen.
It could happen. I hate to leave it on a Bears comment, but unless anyone else has anything else.
The Bears suck. How's that for a Bears comment?
Yes. I love it. Thank you so much for your time, Ken. Is there anything you want to say before we sign off?
No, you guys have been great. I always love coming on and talking about football. Man, I appreciate you guys being patient with me when I screwed up my alarm. Thank you so much. I had a blast. It was a lot of fun.
It was amazing. You've given us far more time than I thought would happen. So I'm really appreciative of that and so engaging. So thank you so much. And hopefully we'll speak to you in the future.
Thank you, sir. You have a good day. Thanks, guys.
Thank you guys. Bye.